Hello, and welcome to What is Wrong with Hiring, the podcast where we talk about why hiring people and getting hired are both absolute nightmares. I'm Amy Santee, a jaded and increasingly less optimistic career coach given the state of the world today. Please be advised that this podcast may contain drinking, swearing, and screaming into the abyss, pretty much like most podcasts.
Fuck. I just want to throw that in there.
Today, I will be hosting solo for an interview with a very special guest, Hang Xu, who is a former UX designer and the founder of Collective Supply, an independent design talent firm based in New York City. Hang is a very active member of the LinkedIn design community and enjoys writing about design strategy, activism in tech, and salary negotiation techniques, among many other topics of interest. I first met Hang maybe a year or so ago on LinkedIn, and since then I've really enjoyed his very timely and astute content about the state of tech and design hiring. And Hang, I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about Collective Supply and what got you started in the talent recruitment space.
Yeah, so about a year ago, I burned out really badly from the design field, and I had been doing design for almost 10 years at the point, and it just got to a point where I needed to get out and do something different, but I still love design. I just couldn't get down with the day-to-day stuff so much. And I felt like design recruiting was a nice skip over to something else that I felt like had some serious fundamental problems I would love to solve. So as we all know, design recruiting can be quite maligned at times by people, especially designers or candidates who went through a process and that they felt were were suboptimal. That's why I wanted to get into it and try to help solve some of the foundational issues that I was seeing. And Collective Supply started out as a pro bono service where I was helping businesses match with designers, and that slowly morphed into a paid service. And it just got really interesting with all the layoffs that were happening.
And Collective Supply, how did you come up with that name? To me, when I think of collective, I think of collective organizing or something community oriented. And I know that you describe your agency as candidate centric. So it seems related to that somehow.
Yeah, absolutely. I really wanted to build something that was day-centric. I wanted to have something that cared more about the candidate side than just the hiring side. And that was really difficult because pretty much every recruiter is paid by the company when they make a hire. I'm just talking about external recruiting agencies. Mm-hmm. And they're almost never paid by the candidate. And if they were, then they'd be pretty much coaches, right? So in many ways, candidates think of recruiters as somebody who should be on their side, who's helping them, who's matching them with the company that they want to work at. But from a monetary standpoint, that's not the case at all. So the experiment for me was, can I be paid by the business or the company and still try to create a really good experience for the candidate?
That's awesome. I love that approach, and hiring and the job search, all of those processes are pretty unequal to begin with, the power dynamics, the lack of advocacy. And I think there are some recruiters within companies or agencies that do care about candidates, but their hands are tied when it comes to advocating for them and being an equal representative.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think there certainly are recruiters out there that many would consider to be unethical. Like they do things that could be a little bit sleazy. But I think by and large, almost all recruiters are ethical. They're trying to do their best, and they're working in a system that does not promote ethical behavior, unfortunately. And being a recruiter is it's unfortunately quite exploitative as well. Oftentimes, recruiters who are working in agencies don't get paid out unless the role is filled and the person stays on for 3 months or 6 months or however long. And there are times when recruiters can sink many dozens of hours on a role and still come out with absolutely nothing because the company, for whatever reason, did not make a hire. Mm-hmm. So out of all these systems, I think we start to see some kind of systematic issues that would eventually crop up. And I truly believe that is the root cause of most subpar experiences that people have had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And going back to what you said about recruiters and the constraints that they're working in, I think right now is obviously really bad because recruiting has been hit so hard. Internal company recruiters have been let go in huge numbers. Hiring freezes are still in place, or hiring can be really low, generally speaking, fewer jobs. And so I think a lot of recruiters are working with even less now. They have less time, they have fewer resources. But what I haven't seen change really are hiring processes. It seems like they're all still very long. There's a lot involved. People have to go through the same rigmarole that they did over the past several years. And I feel like I would have expected that to change as well, but it doesn't seem to. I don't know. What have you noticed with that?
I think the hiring process has changed a little bit, but more on the back end of things that the candidate doesn't really see oftentimes. Mm. It feels like things are dragging out a little bit longer. It feels like hiring managers are maybe a little bit pickier nowadays with a much wider or much larger pool of talent that we're seeing on the market. And that allows them to dig a little bit deeper or to be more selective in the interview process so they can ask for more from candidates and also dig deeper and try to figure out if they're really the right fit.
Yeah. And even though that might be beneficial for them to have more of a selection to choose from, to me, it means that they're spending more resources, time, and money on the hiring process. And doesn't seem like hiring manager resources have grown. They've probably shrunk. So that comes to mind for me. And it's less fair now for candidates. I know several people who have applied for the same UX research job at a particular company, and none of them have been given an offer after going through the entire process. And I'm like, what are they looking for? All of these people are really talented. Like, they could go in and do this job really well. The hiring process for this one role seems to be going on for several months now. So going back to what you said about things taking longer, I think that's a frustration that people are having. And people need jobs. They run out of money. They need to support their families. That is a huge hit that people take. And to me, things just seem a lot more unfair right now than in the past.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. I think from a philosophical standpoint, I do think when you talk about power dynamics and fairness, things aren't very good for the average candidate right now, even the average senior candidate. However, I would urge people to really not think about this from a fairness perspective, because that would just serve to drive you nuts at this moment. And really consider it from the standpoint of maybe variance or just probability. And right now, it certainly feels, if you're not considered for a role or you don't get further in the process, it's oftentimes less to do with your actual ability to do the day-to-day work or your qualifications, and more so on just random luck. Like, perhaps this role had 800 applications that they saw, and you happen to be the right after the cutoff line that the recruiter decided, hey, I'm going to, you know, look through all these candidates and talk to the first 30 that I find to be qualified, and that's all the time I have. Unfortunately, everyone afterwards is going to not be considered. So that has much less to do with your qualifications and more to do with luck and timing and just random variance at this point.
Yeah. I think biases come up as well. There's already an internal candidate and they're like, oh, we should just interview people. You're right. There's a lot of external factors that are at play here. And I want to come back to your LinkedIn content. You're one of the only people whose posts that I have actually subscribed to for notifications. So every time you post something, which is usually in the mornings, I literally wake up, open my phone, go to LinkedIn, and I see a notification for your post. So thank you for providing me with some entertaining way to wake up in the morning, first of all. But your posts are just really on point, and I always appreciate your very critical take on things, which I think does a great job of tapping into the zeitgeist of design and opening up important conversations within the community on LinkedIn, which is a really great platform for that. I think that it's really helpful for shifting mindsets and educating people and making it safer for people to talk about the issues they face as a collective sort of experience. So thank you for all of that. One thing I'd like to call out specifically is that you do a really great job of using satire and comedy and visual design for your commentary on all of this ridiculousness in tech hiring and in the design discipline itself. I really love all of the UI or user interface mockups of the fake workday features and LinkedIn features, like one you posted recently with a LinkedIn Premium feature to notify you which candidates beat you for the job opening that you had applied for. Another one recently was the Flash Pass feature to get your job application to the front of the line for a small fee. And another one, which I really loved, was the rewards program for job interviews where candidates can select from a series of gift cards for various White Castle combo meals or a Bed Bath & Beyond 20% off coupon, which, do they exist anymore?
They do, but only online. So rest in peace to all the brick and mortar Bed Bath & Beyond stores.
Yeah. So why do you think these posts resonate with people? You get hundreds and thousands of reactions and tons of comments.
Thank you. I'm flattered. I think partially it's because Workday is just seared into people's psyche. It's one of the few tools that people are forced to use. And the experience is not great at times. I think we've all had some pretty bad experiences with Workday and also with Concur. And it's infuriating, especially to UX designers, because it's almost like a slap in the face. It's proof right there that UX does not really matter when it comes to the success of a company. Concur is probably worth billions of dollars, same with Workday. And they're highly successful companies with great adoption rates, great engagement, and lots of sales with probably not the best UX in the world. And I think the other reason why it could possibly resonate with people is because the premise that I typically start off with these designs is, what if you were to give a graphical user interface to what's happening right now? When CEOs or the executive team decides to do a layoff, they do have to roughly select the groups or people that they would be cutting. And I would like to imagine that they are using some kind of tool to do this, like using some kind of a low-tech Microsoft Word or Excel spreadsheet to do something. Why don't we build a graphical user interface or a tool to do it more efficiently? So that's been a lot of fun. And it gets crazier and crazier. But the saddest thing is always somebody reaching out to me, somebody like typically an old timer, someone would say, yeah, I made a tool just like this a while back, and it's absolutely used. And it's unfortunately part of how businesses operate. So it's not that far-fetched. It's just nice to give a modern UI to it.
Yeah, and applying some of these concerns that people have about how are layoffs actually happening and how are people being selected. And there's a lot of Wizard of Oz behind the scenes stuff that we just don't know about. I'd love to shift now into the topic at hand for today's conversation, which is UX maturity, user experience or design maturity within organizations, and how can we assess the level or quality of UX maturity when we are interviewing at a place where we might want to work? And UX maturity is something that I think most UX professionals are concerned with because of the challenges that low maturity environments present for doing good work and having an impact through design. It's very common frustration. And when I'm working with clients who are in the job search, most of them are trying to figure out how to evaluate the organization, like how to understand where they're at in terms of how design is integrated into the organization, into product development. And that's how I think about design maturity, coming down to is it something that the business really prioritizes? Is it more of an afterthought? How important is the user experience? Is it more or less important than other functions within a business like engineering or product? And again, all of that having an impact on the way designers want to work and the impact that they would like to have in a product space. So I'm curious, how would you define UX or design maturity?
Oh boy, I feel like we're talking about the onion that is design maturity. And there's so many layers to it. I think there's a philosophical layer, and there's maybe a historical layer as well. And then there would be the many scales or levels that companies like NNG and Envision have come up with to help people understand and act as a marketing brochure for their management services. And there's also, of course, the interpersonal aspect to it and the deeply personal views or experiences that unique individual designers experience when they work at a company. And I think perhaps in this episode, we could talk a little bit more about that, because I imagine most of your clients are thinking about it from that perspective. Would mm-hmm. I be happy working at this company, as opposed to what is the meaning of design maturity over the span of decades? And what is UX even? So from the perspective of someone who is interviewing at a company, I think it comes down to, how do you define design maturity, or how do you experience work? And that's so different for people. I think the best example I can think of is I managed someone briefly a while back who was more of a visual focused designer, who was very happy to create a lot of really beautiful visual designs. And at the time, my interpretation of design maturity was more about, how can we build something that created an ROI for a business case so that we can get more funding, we can be more integrated into the product development process. And by introducing all these things like user stories, roadmaps, and backlogs and all that, it actually created a lot more friction for this other designer who really didn't want to deal with that. And to them, design maturity was something entirely different. So a lot of it, I believe, is quite cultural. And it also has a lot to do with your interpersonal idiosyncrasies and how you like to navigate work, how you treat work, how you want to do things, and how you see your own career. So there are so many factors involved. And perhaps an easier way for us to navigate this is to ask ourselves, think of a time when you were really struggling at work, when you just, your energy was sapped and you were constantly stressed out. What were the factors that were causing all this? And perhaps these factors are what's contributing to design immaturity to you. And then also think about times when you were energized, when you really enjoyed work, when you went to work and it felt like the hours flew by and you were getting a lot out of it. You felt like your career was growing, your skills were growing, and you were very satisfied. What were the factors that contributed to that? And perhaps that's the meaning of design maturity to you. So at the end of the day, design maturity to the individual designer is, how much satisfaction are you getting from work, or dissatisfaction? And immaturity would be the negative aspect, and maturity would be the positive aspects.
I really love how you put that. We can look at suggested frameworks or models for UX maturity. We can think about UX maturity within an organization, within teams. But yeah, bringing it back to, what do we individually care about at work, in our lives? And I ask my clients to reflect on those very questions when they are exploring and coming up with a list of their personal and professional core values. And then what they do with those values is define them in, what does that mean in their day-to-day at work, and then start to prioritize those things so you can assess roles and organizations and managers based on like very specific criteria. And I'm wondering, let's imagine you were going to go back into design and look for a design role for yourself. What are some things that you would look for? What are some things that you care about?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would do is to take stock of my situation and really think about what do I want in the next step of my career? And then take a hard look at what the market is and try to talk to as many other designers as possible in different companies and get a better idea of what they're experiencing. And I think that's important just so that you have a more realistic view of what is achievable, like how much work is involved in getting to where you want to be. I don't know if it's necessarily the best idea. And I think this is more to do with my personality than anything else. I'm not recommending anyone else do this. To not focus directly on what it is that you want to achieve and more just look at it holistically and think about how much effort, energy, and time you need to invest in getting something that you really want. And for me, some of the most important things that I see as foundational that I would not violate under the vast majority of circumstances would be things like having a really good manager. So I wouldn't even say that's part of design maturity in many ways, because that's certainly not on the NNG or the Envision scales or any other design maturity scales. But I do think that has an outsized impact on my experience as a designer. And I do think there's a strong correlation between how I view the design maturity level of a company and the quality of the manager that I have. And for whatever reason, that's just never mentioned. So the way I typically look at managers would be in three layers. The most important thing would be, is this person an asshole? They have to be a good person, someone that you can trust. And if that's not the case, then nothing else really matters. And the next thing would be, the next layer would be, this manager needs to, well, ideally would have a set of skills that you want to learn and get better at. And it doesn't have to be design. It can be things that you would like to improve upon, because at a certain point as a designer, it's not just your design skills. There are also a lot of other interpersonal skills that come into play, being charismatic, being great at sales, presentation, public speaking, and cross-functional collaboration. These are all very important skills that you can learn from a really good manager. Hmm. And if I can identify what these skills are during the interview process, that can really excite me about the opportunities of working with this person. And the third thing is, ideally, this manager has organizational clout. As in, if we decide to do something and we have a really good plan, this manager would be able to action on it. And there have been instances in my career where I have a great manager and that this person is really nice, has a bunch of skills, but for whatever reason, they did not have the organizational clout to really push any of our initiatives forward. So we were just spinning our wheels. And I think at this point in my career, it's really more so about the people than ever before. So making sure that I really like the product manager and some of my most closely with some of the close cross-functional partners I would have on engineering and also with the executive leadership. If these things all check out, then I think that's going to be a lot more impactful than working on a product that I'm really excited about or working on the cutting edge of things or even salary at this point.
Some other things that I think about are, is there design representation at the executive level? Which that's not always the case. What is the budget healthy? And that's a big question right now because budgets have been sliced and people have been let go. What's the ratio of design or research to other functions like engineering? A really important one for people who appreciate research as part of product design is, does the organization have researchers and what type of research is done? I'm curious if there are any other things that you would suggest people look for when trying to figure out this question.
Yeah, I think every candidate should think about their ideal process, or at least which processes they worked in the past that they really enjoyed and which processes did they really struggle with, and try to identify which parts or which components of it either offended them or gave them more energy. And to some designers, it could be not having done any research or instances where the company just didn't do any retrospection. They didn't really look back at what went well, what didn't go well. They just let everything go, like things that completely failed. They just never talked about again. And that could be very frustrating to people. So if you understand the ideal process that you would like to work in, then the next step would be to figure out what is the current process that the company uses to build products. What is their product development lifecycle like? And the questions I typically recommend people use would be behavioral questions. So instead of asking about what is your process like, because the interviewer would, I guess, give a more concise version to make it sound a little bit better. We use research where user-centric, et cetera, and our process agile. All these terminologies are meaningless, ultimately, at the interview level. And instead, you want to ask them behavioral questions or historical questions, like, tell me about the last feature that you shipped. How did the idea come about? Can you walk me from beginning to end? How was it built? And what was the success or failure of this feature? Typically, I ask about 3 to 5 features that they shipped in the past year or two, and how design was involved, how it wasn't. And that gives me a pretty good idea of their process and how well it might jive with mine, or maybe it's completely incompatible. And if it sounds too perfect, then that's actually a data point, because oftentimes no process is ever perfect. No feature is ever shipped without any major issues. So it's usually evidence that you should dig a little bit deeper, ask tougher questions, really.
So. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of people are like, oh, I don't know if I want to do that. Is it going to come off as too assertive, or I don't feel like I have enough time to ask those questions? And my advice to people is prepare for the questions you want to ask, the conversations you want to have, know the data you're trying to collect, formulate those questions. And I think what you suggested is a great idea. It's like candidates answering behavioral questions from people on the interview panel using the STAR framework: situation, task, action, result. And I think it's totally fair to expect other people to be able to respond to questions with specific examples. I'm curious if there are any red flags for you that are absolute no's. If you come across this, you are basically just going to walk away.
I think at this point in my career, I would say take-home design exercises are obvious red flags. And the biggest reason why I walk away from it is because it's not a very good use of my time from a candidate's perspective. And there's just so much work involved in the interviewing process. As a candidate, you're preparing your portfolio, and that can take dozens, if not hundreds of hours. And you're making sure that you can interview well. So you're preparing all the stuff that you would say and the ideas that you have, how you respond to common interview questions, and then just the interview grind itself, right? If you get deep enough, you're probably investing close to 10 hours of your time. 10 hours per company. So typically, if you're investing your time and energy, you want to do that on things that are reusable. So The issue with design exercises is that you do it once and it's not something that you can reuse later on. Whereas if you were to spend this 5 or 10 hours on your portfolio, it would be much more valuable to you as a candidate, because that allows you to reuse it for every single future job interview that you have. Beyond that, I also think anytime a company is disrespectful, and that's different for everyone, of course, because we all interpret things differently and we all have triggers that can be quite different as well. So making sure that their process or how they speak to you isn't super offensive to you, I think that's important early on, because it typically doesn't get better once you join the team. And also having the opportunities to ask questions. I know you mentioned earlier that sometimes candidates or your clients don't feel comfortable asking these questions because they might come across as too interrogative or there's not enough time. I do think it's really important to make that time. And it also shows a healthy amount of mutual respect when the company gives you time to understand their background better, because it's a two-way decision in many ways. It's not just them saying, we have a job and you should be so happy and thankful and lucky that we're offering this to you. And you, instead, it's more seen as a partnership where both sides are mutually agreeing to work together. So finding that time, making sure they're open to it is very important. And if they're not making that available to you, then you really have to wonder, do they not respect candidates? Do they not want to work with somebody who can be too forward, perhaps? Or they just want somebody to shut up and crank out designs? Or they don't feel that your questions are important? Or maybe they're just so inundated with work that they can't find that extra 20, 30 minutes to help you in the interview process. I feel that if a company really wants you, they'll make that time.
These are common frustrations and experiences for people. And considering today's job market, where there's far fewer jobs, there's way more people looking for jobs, it seems challenging to envision and expect this ideal interview process, or to hope to find an organization where the grass is greener. And I always wonder, where is the grass greener? I feel like the grass is half dead at most places in terms of toxicity, stakeholder issues, what we've been discussing with design maturity and the quality of work life that people are looking for. And so it's, I care about all this stuff, but also I really need a job. And also I need to play the game. I need to show up and perform interviews in a way that makes me look palatable and appealing. How should people think about all of this?
Yeah, that's really tough. We can't deny the shifting power dynamics right now and just how difficult it is for many job seekers. It's not just how they're treated in the interview process, but just dealing with the interpersonal challenge, not interpersonal, but like the personal challenges of getting rejected over and over again, or not hearing back, and applying to multiple places over the span of months and seeing your unemployment funds run out eventually. So it's incredibly difficult. And I think at this point, it might even be healthy to think about this as just the job and see that perhaps design maturity is not the most important thing right now. Like, you do have to take care of your family. You do have to take care of yourself. And that's the thing that I've struggled with a lot in my career, because my goal at every single company is to improve the design maturity, or my version of that. And I've conceded over time to realize that a lot of it is very egotistical, because it's talking about my ideal way of doing things. And even if I feel that this is logically correct, it is better, it's more efficient, there's less wastage, and there's more money saved. And at the end of the day, we're a business. We're trying to make money, right? Save money, make money, whatever. Does it really matter? Because the cost of doing something like that is quite high, because companies don't really want to change at the end of the day. And one of the most concerning things that I realized was, when we talk about design maturity, we talk about it as something that can be radically shifted and improved within the matter of months at the hands of a skilled design leader. And that's just not the case. Like, I've never in my experience seen an environment that improved their design maturity at a level that was palpable in the span of anything less than 2 years, to be honest. And that's a hard pill to swallow for many people, for many designers, knowing that it's going to take you many years, and a lot of it is completely out of your control. Some of the biggest changes happen because somebody at the leadership level left or was replaced by somebody else. And there's a lot of backsliding happening too. When a really good design leader gets a better opportunity elsewhere, all the hard work that you put into it in a way disappears, because that linchpin is no longer there. So I oscillate. I go back and forth on this. Some days where I feel like this is super important. This is about doing really good work. And if you're a designer or a craftsman, then you should care about it. And then there are other days when I feel like the emotional labor aspect is quite taxing. And the one thing that's really shifted for me over the years wasn't the design maturity being improved at a company, but it was actually the decline of my mental health. So at the end of the day, what's more important, right? And am I just being silly or stupid or short-sighted? Mm-hmm. Depending on the day you ask me this question, I'll have a different answer.
Both and. It could be all of these things. And it's nuanced. And I think it goes back to what you were saying about each of our individual needs and desires and goals and priorities. And I feel the same way about my own experience in UX, where I was always very passionate about my work. I saw a lot of opportunities for impact, not just in product and business strategy, but also organizationally, like a lot of issues that I thought could be improved to make things better for teams and the product, because what's going on organizationally does show up in and affect actual user experience in my mind. And in hindsight, I realized I cared too much. I cared about too many things. The things that I did care about, I cared too much about those things. I wasn't really thinking about my individual capacity. I was hoping and expecting other people to care as much about these issues and improving them as I did. And if I could go back and give myself some advice, I would say, just don't care as much. It's just a job. Do what you can. You're one person. If you don't have much collective power within an organization, there's only so much you can do about cultural issues and all of that stuff. And I think I would have been able to survive more easily and maybe even thrive a bit more if I, at the end of the day, said I tried my best, I did my research, I presented it, I know it was great. People can take it and decide what they want to do with it at that point. So that is definitely something I see with a lot of people who are really passionate and who get really jaded and burned out about these challenges. Can I just look at this as a job and do my best? And I think the pandemic and all these layoffs have also caused people to rethink their relationship with work and ask, what's really important to me? And does it really matter what the UX maturity is? Or can I just go in and do the best that I can?
We talk quite a bit about our own, just our mental health or how we view design and what the environment is like at the company. And we haven't even touched on what it's like for the users of the products that we design and build. And that can be much bigger at times. If you're working at a company that has a product that's being used by millions or billions of people, and it's deeply affecting them, it's changing our democracy, our government, changing our day-to-day living standards, our work, that makes it even tougher. And honestly, I don't know. I feel like the scary thing to me is that whenever I talk to people like you and me, we say these things that maybe it's just work, we shouldn't care so much about it. But I don't know if that's a switch that a lot of us can just flip.
Mm-hmm.
We're constantly saying that, but it feels like our actions aren't necessarily in line with what we are saying. And I think that part is a little scary to me, because to be honest, you and I didn't really flip that switch and say, you know what? Fuck it. It's just work. So let's just go in, clock out, collect the paycheck, and not think too much about it. We have treated it almost as an all or nothing, right? Either we are 100% in it with our heart and passion and soul, or we say, fuck it, and we get out of it and we do something completely different. And I think the tough part, and maybe this is the recipe for a happy designer or a more effective designer, is to find that balance between fighting really hard for something that we really care about and believe in, and at times just realizing that this is just how capitalism works and we're collecting a paycheck. And what's the most important thing to us is maybe just our family that we go home to and our hobbies and our lives, right? I wonder if other industries and other functions think about it like this, where they probably do, but I wonder if designers think about it a little bit more than others. And maybe do we treat it as an all or nothing thing?
That's a great question in my mind, because design as a discipline within organizations has so many challenges due to lack of access to power and resources, essentially. I think that's what causes us to ask these questions and try to deal existentially with our work and how it relates to our individual selves and our personal value and the kind of impact we want to see in the world. And yeah, I think having a balance is very important. It can't just, it's a spectrum where you can pick and choose what to care about and how much to care about those things with the goal of having a paycheck to sustain your life. And I think just the awareness, if I had more awareness about my capacity and ability to have impact, I probably could have had a much more healthy perspective and not have been experiencing burnout at almost every single job and just quitting my last corporate job because I couldn't take it anymore. Although I will say, yes, it did drastically improve my mental health. And even in thinking about my coaching practice now, I do see it as just a job. I think it's something that I'm good at, that I can do for a business. I do care about having impact and I get to have a lot more impact. But I have also grown in such a way, I think, reflecting on all of these experiences and working with a lot of people to see it as separate from my personal identity. I love that people are asking these questions and reflecting on things at this time. And we all work within the constraints of this system and capitalism, like you said, and our options are limited. So we can only, yeah, do so much with that.
I have a personal question for you.
Sure.
If you were to go back to full-time UX work at a corporate environment or a startup, do you think this time around you'll be able to find balance?
Yeah, I believe I would have a much healthier perspective on things. I'm not going to say I wouldn't get frustrated at stuff. I would do my best to evaluate the job that's in front of me based on these things we've been discussing and go, okay, what's really important? What do I care about? What do I prioritize that maybe is different from what I was prioritizing in the past? And I'll never say never. Who knows? Maybe something really cool would come up in the future. But I do believe that would be the case because I have the tools and the awareness and the perspective after reflecting on all of this stuff. And again, I see these challenges come up with a lot of conversations with my clients who are trying to decide where to go and should I quit this job that is soul-sucking even though I make really good money and what do I do differently? And one option is to stay and maybe shift your perspective or mindset on your current situation. But yeah, I think I could do a lot better with that. I don't know. How about you?
To be honest, I don't know. I think the year away definitely helped me be more introspective to really think through what went right, what went poorly, and how I could have done things differently. And how in the future, when I come across something similar, I'll be able to navigate it much more effectively. And just be an easier to work with designer. But at the same time, I don't know if I can really pull myself away from design and just treat it as a job. And that's the part that, to be honest, scares me a little bit. Like, why do I have such a hard time doing that? Is it because I see myself as a designer in terms of my identity? Or is it an egotistical thing that I need to work out? Or is it some kind of childhood trauma that creates all these trigger points for me? And I think it's just really complex. And that's in many ways exciting because you're learning about yourself. At the same time, it's not easy. And I've spent quite a lot of time and money on therapy. I think that's helped a lot. And also should think more about getting a career coach because it's a lot harder than I thought it would be when I first started out as a designer.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Like, what are some resources and tools that designers can lean on outside of work? Support groups of other practitioners, therapists, other reflective activities. What can help bring some of that awareness and balance? Absolutely. I think that is all the time we have for today. So thank you again, Hang. I really appreciate you coming on the show. This is the first interview that we've had on the show in quite some time. So really appreciate you joining.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Good. And thanks to our listeners. If there's a question or a topic you'd like us to discuss or an interview guest that you want us to bring on, please reach out to me on LinkedIn because, unlike Laura, I am the one who does all the emotional labor for this podcast. And if anyone is so inclined, we deeply appreciate your support. So if you like the show, please subscribe and leave a rating, but only if you want to give us 5 stars because anything less than perfection is unacceptable. Once again, I'm Amy Santee, and we want to thank all of you for listening and wish you all the best of luck with your search. No matter what you're looking for, we are rooting for you.